Good evening and welcome this evening to the second in the of the Hayek lectures that we're hosting here at the LSE, the first having been held last year. And this has been funded with generous support from one of our alumni, Toby Baxendale, and we're very grateful for his financial support for this series and also for the Hayek Fellowship. Our speaker this evening is serving in two capacities. He's both the Hayek Fellow and the Hayek Lecturer this year. Of course, Hayek was an important figure at the LSE and in the LSE Economics Department in particular, and we're delighted to have this lecture to honor him. This evening's lecturer is Pete Becke from George Mason University, and he's going to talk on Hayek and market socialism, science, ideology, and public policy. Pete is very well qualified to give a lecture such as this. Apart from being professor of economics at George Mason, he also serves as research director at the Mercatus Center and deputy director of the James Buchanan Center for Political Economy. His published work is mainly in the field of the political economy of comparative systems. He's written books on the political economy of Soviet socialism, the formative years 1918 to 28, and Calculation and Coordination, Essays on Socialism and Transitional Political Economy. He's one of the leading representatives of the modern Austrian school of economics and has served as editor of the Review of Austrian Economics. He was also the editor of The Legacy of Hayek, Philosophy, Politics, and Economics in three volumes. Hayek, as you know, was a great believer in the importance of decentralized information and communication, but I think even he would draw the line at having people's mobile phones go off in the middle of his memorial lecture. So I ask you at this point maybe to check whether your mobile is switched on and turn it off or turn it on to silent as appropriate. Anyway, I'm delighted to welcome Pete both to the LSE. He's actually been here a short while, but he'll be here for longer too for those of you who'd like to meet with him, but more particularly to invite him to the podium to give his Hayek lecture. Thank you very much, Pete.
Thank you very much for those words, Tim. It's a great honor for me to have this opportunity to speak at this great institution of economic thought and on this occasion to honor F.A. Hayek, a man of keen intellect and great courage. Hayek's career spanned from the 1920s to the 1980s, and he taught at five universities, but the LSE was the school that he taught at for the longest period of time. He never gave up his British citizenship. He always said he felt more at home in Britain than anywhere else, certainly more than in America. And this is also, more importantly, where his ideas took shape. If you look at Bruce Caldwell's biography of Hayek, Hayek's Challenge, he talks about these LSE years as the main area where Hayek got all of his ideas for that cover the rest of his career. It's true that he had his formative period in Vienna, and the questions of capital theory and monetary theory drove him in the beginning, but the way that he came to understand the importance of those issues took place here in his discussions at the LSE with his colleagues. I'm very thankful to the staff at the LSE for coordinating my visit, to Tim for being a gracious and welcoming host, and of course to Toby Baxendale for his respect for the ideas of the old LSE tradition of Plant, Robbins, Hayek, Coase, and Bauer, and his vision of how these ideas can be revitalized and advanced to both improve our understanding and realize a freer and more economically prosperous state of affairs. I have chosen as my topic Hayek and market socialism, and I have done so for a variety of reasons. First one is that it's this debate that Hayek's research program in philosophy, politics, and economics emerged. Second point, Hayek's main contributions to that debate took place while he was here at the LSE. And three, the topic, while some might think it the case, is not an example of beating a dead horse, because the subtlety of Hayek's argument, I will contend, is not fully appreciated, and its relevance for contemporary debates in economics and public policy is not generally recognized. One of the great tragedies of Hayek's legacy, I think, is that his books have become coffee table books, what we would call in the United States coffee table books. I think everyone here can understand that. That means that if you're an intelligent person, you should have a book by Hayek but you shouldn't read it. You should just look at it. And this has become Hayek's fate, and I'm going to try to suggest that there's other reasons maybe why we should read him. And I should, in all complete honesty, also add in that I'm my American pragmatism in the choice of this title, which is that I had just been recently asked to contribute an essay on this subject to the a book that Cambridge University Press is publishing, and so better yet to kill two birds with one stone. And so this is my first stab at this paper and whatnot, so please bear with me. All right, so Hayek and market socialism, science, ideology, and public policy. All right, what's the basic argument in this paper? The basic argument in the paper is that Hayek's critique of socialism was grounded in his scientific understanding of economics, that Hayek's ideological position was a consequence of his science, not the other way around. Three, that Hayek's position in this debate had direct policy relevance during his life and still has lasting relevance for today. And this is this point about that I want to suggest that his position, if it is appreciated not as an ideological one, but instead as a scientific proposition, set of scientific propositions, then his scientific contributions, were they to be understood, would transform economics, both at a theoretical and an empirical level. Just so that I admit that what's going on in economics, my own view is that economics is more exciting today than it's ever been in terms of the nature of the discipline, the kind of questions that economists are pursuing. And so if any of you are in here are graduate students in economics, this is the best time since I became an economist to study economics. On a theoretical and empirical level, what's going on is very fascinating. And at the LSE, Tim's work is one of the great examples of that, actually. So you're very fortunate. You could go to a lot of other places where interesting work wouldn't be going on, and you're fortunate that you're not there. So, all right. So some basic background to understanding Hayek. Again, let me plug Bruce Caldwell's book. Bruce Caldwell just is the new editor of Hayek's collected works, and his book, Hayek's Challenge, is the first sort of systematic biography of Hayek. I'm not going to be sort of retelling sort of the Hayek story as told through Caldwell, because you can read Caldwell's book. I want to emphasize slightly something different and focus on this debate in the 1930s and Hayek's subsequent position afterwards. But in order to understand what Hayek was trying to argue in that debate, I think it's important to see where he came from. Mary Morgan's in the audience, and she's a top-rate historian of economic thought. I work in the area of history of economic thought, but I'm mainly more a consumer of history of economic thought and a utilizer of history of economic thought to contextualize modern economics historically rather than the production of actual history of economics, which I think is one of the more interesting intellectual history fields that's going on at the moment. And this will be an example of this. In fact, I wrote an essay defending history of thought on the grounds that we should have consumers and producers, and that as a consumer, I can be an opportunistic consumer. I can use history of thought exactly however the heck I want to use it in order to sort of make it, sort of work in this way for theories. That's sort of what I'm going to do tonight, rather than the idea of actually getting at what Hayek actually said. I don't really care that much about that. But so what's the basic background for understanding Hayek's substantive contribution to political economy? The first one is the recognition that he gets from Menger. The timing of all of these, by the way, is very important, because when he came to the LSE, you have to understand a few things about the LSE in the 1930s. One of them was that Beveridge was in control of things, but he didn't exactly like John Maynard Keynes as a person, though his theories are under consumption theories are similar to Keynes. And he saw in Robbins someone who was not a Keynesian, and therefore it didn't matter that Robbins was also not a Beveridge follower. What mattered is that he wasn't John Maynard Keynes. And so therefore they also were able to get Hayek. And what Robbins and Hayek set out to do, to conspire, was actually a conspiracy, was to challenge Oxbridge. And that is, how are they going to do that? If everything is in Marshall, There's no way that if you just teach Marshall again, and if everything is just historical or fact-driven, like Beveridge thought or whatnot, then that's kind of, from Hayek and Robbins' point of view, that's sort of boring, not really doing science. So what they did was they imported continental economics into the LSE. So Italian economics, Swedish economics, Austrian economics all became dominant trends here in the LSE, and it led to a tremendous amount of great research. If you read Hicks's biographies of his own ideas, for example, it was in Hayek telling him to read Pareto that he then ended up by doing the work with Hicks and Allen that led to indifference curve analysis and whatnot. It was Hayek's suggestion in his microeconomics course. And what Hayek did was they started this rare track series. And in those rare tracks, one of the first books that they did was Menger's Principles. And Hayek was writing the introduction for that book at the time that he also started to address these issues about the nature of the price system and what actually he sees as a connection. So these ideas are all going to come in here very quickly. I'm going to try to go through this fast. Menger's contribution to economics, the idea that value resides in the sort of mind of the individual consumer, and that the outcomes or the most important questions in the social sciences are what you could call spontaneous orders, not constructed orders. This idea, of course, is seen throughout Hayek's entire career. This subjectivism translates into the notion of dispersed knowledge that's divided up into millions of individuals within the economy. And the spontaneous order, of course, is the what Hayek would later refer to as the miracle of the coordinating process of the market. From Wieser, what he learned, Wieser was actually technically Hayek's teacher, what he learned was the idea of persistent and consistent opportunity cost reasoning, which is another great LSE tradition. In fact, James Buchanan sort of immortalized this in an essay called LSE Lectures and Costs. It's a book that he published in the 1960s as a companion volume to his own book in fundamental theory called Cost and Choice, and sort of the opportunity cost reasoning tradition in economics. And this originates with Wieser, but it also relates to the idea of production in an uncertain, you know, period or through time, and how is it that value chains flow up, all right, from, like, if I have consumer goods that have prices, how is it that I impute the value of the higher order goods, which those higher goods go to satisfy these consumer goods. So how is it that value flows up and goods and services flow back down to consumers? This was a question of imputation theory. And this was Hayek's original work. This is actually his doctoral dissertation is in that area of imputation theory. This is going to, again, come about because it's about coordination. If you think about the coordination problem and you think about a world which is, in fact, through time, the coordination problem becomes much more difficult than the idea that if you have a circular flow notion of coordination. So the issues that involve Hayek in the 1930s and 40s with his debates with Frank Knight over the maintenance of capital and whatnot come out of this idea of the way he sees the capital structure as a process through time as opposed to a circular flow. Wicksell's work in Capital and Expectations, and a very important theme that's going to come up is the idea of correct foresight as a defining characteristic of equilibrium, not as a precondition. One of the important things about that comes out of this debate in the 1930s from Hayek is that the optimality conditions that we associate with markets are the resultant of a market process, not assumptions going in. So it's not the case that economic actors are maximizing profit, for example, or trying to equate marginal revenue with marginal cost. In fact, they might, in Hayek's framework, they might be very lazy people, but what happens is the institutions of capitalism serve as a funnel and a weeding out mechanism. And so as a result, what ends up happening is any behavior that deviates from the optimality conditions is going to be penalized, all right, and therefore forcing people. And so the resultant is one of a dovetailing of foresight, dovetailing of plans, not an assumption going in, because Hayek and his countrymate Morgenstern believed that if agents had perfect foresight, they would be in fact stalled with one another and you couldn't get to an equilibrium position. This is an extremely important theoretical position for those guys. And the final person is Mises. Now, you know, we talk about the Austrian school. Mises, for example, always denied that there was such an Austrian school. He said all there was Mises and Wechsel. You know, he says people call it the Austrian school, but there's just me and Wechsel. I'm not going to try to do my Viennese accent. I'm overseas. If I was back home, I would, but I won't do that here. So Mises' contribution to economics that Hayek builds up on is in the area of business cycles and, of course, the problems of socialism. In fact, I want to make a point about Mises, which I think is an important one, and it's unfortunate that it's happened this way, is that Mises' friends and foe both treat him much more harshly than he ever deserved analytically. A lot of that is his own fault because he mixed his science with his ideology in a much more explicit way than a lot of other writers do. But at the time, it's no different than the kind of mixing of ideology and science that, say, Karl Marx did, or even, I dare say, John Maynard Keynes did. But Mises gets misunderstood, unfortunately. And the real issue here is that Hayek's research program is a complete Misesian research program. If what you mean by a research program is that you pick up the questions of your teacher and try to work in it, and he does it in a slightly different way. He pursues it in his own unique path, but all of his questions come from Mises. And in that regard, Hayek, in an autobiographical essay, says he's learned more about economics from Ludwig von Mises than any other individual person. And you can see this in, as I said, the example of his business cycle research, problems of socialism, and the different political and economic systems that just so happened. So Hayek and Mises have intertwined research programs but separate political professional fates. Okay. Let's look at Hayek's research program. What I want to suggest here is that Hayek's work is not disjointed, but his wandering is a consequence of his tracking down loose ends and attempts to tidy up the argument. You can see his research program is flowing from these following different major focuses in his career. In the 1920s, what he's focused on is the issue of coordination. Economics is a coordination problem. This culminates in an essay in 1931, which is on price expectations in equilibrium, which is a Copenhagen lecture. But his whole idea is that we need to recast economics as a coordination process through time. And you can see this in the business cycle research, because what he's arguing in the business cycle research is that's a consequence of a malcoordination caused by poor signals that are manipulated by credit, therefore leading people to engage in activities which otherwise they would not have engaged in. And this leads to ships passing in the night. Okay? Buildings that shouldn't have been built are now being built. All right, and as a result, those things have to somehow come back into coordination. And that's his whole story of the boom and bust cycle. And this is how he's developing this thesis. The complex economic order that exists in a market economy unfolds through time, and if you disturb it, and the one unit that can disturb it is the monetary unit. That's why he focuses on that. Because, right, if you follow a sort of a standard account here, a barter economy. So you have a barter economy, goods buy goods, all right? But in a monetary economy, money buys goods, and goods buy money, but goods never buy goods. Hayek is dealing in a monetary economy. Since money is one half of all exchanges, if you distort the monetary unit, you're going to distort the exchanges. And so Hayek's contribution in the 1920s was to show that while it was true, the classical dichotomy in some sense was true against the monetary cranks, poor people, let's just print more money, it's not the case that reals only affect reals and nominals only affect nominals, that is, that money is only a veil, and instead, money is a loose joint between all the different, production and consumption process. Money's this joint, and if you distort that joint, you're going to end up by distorting the process of coordination, therefore leading to the boom and bust cycle. The connection between Hayek's work in the business cycle theory and his work on socialism should to some extent start kicking into you. It's not like a brand new argument that he gave. It's that the price system has to be free to adjust in order to allocate resources effectively. And that when you rip the economic coordination problem outside of the context of the price system, you in fact are going to now have to have some alternative coordinating device. And Hayek's whole question was, similar to Mises, how are the chickens going to fly into the mouths of the comrades? That's the basic point. It's a simple point. How are the chickens going to fly into the mouths of the comrades unless you have property prices and profit and loss? Because, see, that system coordinates. All right? It allocates our decision about raising chickens and getting them and delivering them to the consumers. And these guys, they did, you know, when you rip it out of that context, it's not going to be there. So this leads to his next work, which is on the use of knowledge in society. I was just reading this morning a very interesting thing. I can't remember the guy's name, but Hayek credits his focus on the dispersed knowledge thing with one of his colleagues here at the LSE who used to make a joke about the givenness of data. And he always used to say to Hayek that economists are worried about this issue of the givenness of data. And Hayek started to think about it, and he said, okay, well, yeah, all right, who is the data given? And what is it that the data is given, and how fast does it adjust? And this is one of the reasons why he started to work on these questions about the dispersal of the data that's in all of our heads. If you think about it, go back to my subjectivism point. I don't want to get too complicated, so I apologize if I do, but the subjectivist point is that somehow you are trapped in solipsism. Okay? The subjective trade-offs or assessment of trade-offs that are in your head somehow become objective information for other people to make those subjective trade-offs. If Hayek's students, again here at the LSE, Shackle and Lockman, who stressed a point of economics in which economics became to some degree poetry, because it was about the moment of choice. Brilliant, wonderful poetry, okay? But the coordination problem gets de-emphasized in their work because they emphasize so much the choice process going on in your head. Hayek had that aspect of economics going on, but he also had this idea about how it is that you could escape from that because your subjective trade-offs become objective information for the next person out there in which they can then utilize. And in this regard, because of the signal quality and the penalties and rewards within the market, you can get dovetailing of plans. Okay, so I don't mean to be too abstract on that, but I think it's important to recognize that Hayek is not pulling a rabbit out, pulling a rabbit out as surprise, or making an assumption that the world works because I assume that the world works. He, in fact, starts with a much more difficult problem situation than the Walrasian model. The Walrasian model, which he was reacting against and which he and Robbins were reacting against, is one in which no false trades take place. There's a pre-reconciliation of plans that take place before the auctioneer can offer the bids. Right? Or start the process. All right? What Hayek is talking about is what happens when we eliminate the auctioneer and people have to reconcile their plans with one another actually through time. It's a more difficult coordination problem, and that's why he focuses on this issue because it's very fragile. The actual market economy, the nature of the price system, is very fragile compared to if you try to intervene in it and try to, you know, distort it and whatnot. The point that he shows later on is going to be that what these liberal institutions provide. So what he focuses on here is a constant changing nature of our data, the way in which we process that data and coordinate with one another, and we learn. The market system is a learning device. Then the question becomes, well, what's the learning environment? All right, so we have coordination, complex dovetailing of plans through time. How is it that those plans get dovetailed through time? Some people have to get the knowledge in order to coordinate through time. Therefore, it's a learning device. You learn how to coordinate. The market is constantly teaching us. All right, there's a constantly adjusting to new and ever fresh data and directing and prodding us in new directions. And then the question is, well, how effective are we at learning? And that's a question of the learning context, the institutions within which we learn. To give you a quick example, right, we have a sort of a norm that we turn the lights on. We don't play loud music when I'm lecturing, right? What if we were in this room and the institutions of this room were, let's dim all the lights and show like the latest movie up on stage and I'm talking over here on the side? I would then be a complete disturbance to you, not at all trying to, you know, teach you anything, and you wouldn't be able to learn it. What Hayek is trying to say is that liberal institutions are, in fact, very good learning institutions for agents. They provide the freedom by which agents learn how to adjust their activity to coordinate with their fellows. And the reason why this is the case is because, as he comes to emphasize, the predictability of the framework, the notion of the rule of law as providing a learning environment in which you sort of transact. Okay. This is Hayek's reflecting back. My wife, I told Tim this before, my wife always picks on me. She says, Pete, they're supposed to be PowerPoints. And she says, you write power paragraphs. But I wanted to put this out. This is from Hayek's essay called Kinds of Rationalism, in that was published in 1964. And it's him reflecting back on his career and why it is he started off going in this direction of this sort of interdisciplinary program in philosophy, politics, and economics. And as he says here, though at one time a very pure, I'll read it off the screen rather than this, though at one time a very pure and narrow economic theorist, I was led from technical economics into all kinds of questions usually regarded as philosophical. When I look back, it seems to have all begun nearly 30 years ago at the LSE, okay, with an essay on economics and knowledge, in which I examined what seemed to me some of the central difficulties of pure economic theory. For those of you who don't know, the central thing in that essay is the difficulty of going from an individual equilibrium, which is a tautology. I, at all times, am in equilibrium because I'm arranging my means to obtain my ends as a person the best that I possibly can, to the idea that somehow the market order is in equilibrium. Ken is arranging his means and ends efficiently, all right? Gene's arranging his means and ends efficiently. Jan's arranging his means and ends efficiently. I'm arranging my means and ends efficiently. How is it that we ever come to swap goods so that those goods are arranged efficiently? Hayek says that's not an answer of pure theory. We can't do it in pure theory. It's a question of the empirical subsidiary assumptions that are required about the way that Ken, Gene, Jan, Pete learn how to swap and engage in mutually beneficial exchange. All right? And so this is the problem. Up to that point, people had thought that if I could demonstrate an individual equilibrium, I could, you know, so derive a societal-wide equilibrium, and Hayek is challenging that idea. Its main conclusion was that the task of economic theory was to explain how an overall economic activity was order of economic activity was achieved, which utilized a large amount of knowledge which was not concentrated in any one mind, but existed only as separate knowledge of thousands or millions of different individuals. But it was still a long way from this to an adequate insight into the relations between the abstract rules which the individual follows in his actions and the abstract overall order which is formed as a result of his responding within the limits imposed upon him by those abstract rules to the concrete particular circumstances which he encounters. It was only through a reexamination of the age-old concept of freedom under the law, the basic conception of traditional liberalism, and of the problems of the philosophy of law which this raises that I have reached what now seems to me a tolerably clear picture of the nature of spontaneous order of which liberal economists have so long been talking. To put it this way, what Hayek is trying to do at this time is to show that the institutions of natural liberty that are in Smith and Hume, right, the idea of property, contract, and consent, are a necessary condition for the invisible hand postulate. All right? The invisible hand postulate only works within certain institutional environments. If those institutional postulates are not there, individuals will be pursuing their self-interest, and you will get an unintended outcome, but it won't necessarily be desirable. This is the contrast between, say, the invisible hand and the tragedy of the commons, both of which require the same style of reasoning. Garrett Hardin was pointing out how individuals pursuing their own self-interest within an environment of the commons, they would overexploit the resource and cause, you know, problems. Whereas what Hayek is doing is championing Adam Smith's idea within a system of property contract and consent, individuals pursuing their own self-interest will be led to generate this overall order. So again, the notions of the liberal society are not, it's these liberal institutions which determine or dictate the ability of the individual self-seeking behavior to lead to the overall order that Hayek sought to explain. So, let's go on to the economics of socialism then. Why is it that the economic debate with socialism is so important if you go back to what I just said? Because socialism was the antithesis of liberalism. You have to remember that. What it argued, either in its revolutionary doctrine, was that you could abolish the institutions of liberalism, or what it argued in its more evolutionary idea, you could somehow peck away and compete and eliminate those institutions eventually. Or, what we'll see in a little bit, you can get the outcomes of those institutions without those institutions. That's actually what his fellow economists at the LSE argued, which we'll see is an important part here. Hayek's argument is that unless you have these various different institutions, you're not going to be able to get these outcomes. These rules dictate the strategy set. So in this regard, Hayek's research program can be legitimately argued to have been pursued as followed by James Buchanan as well. The start state is Hayek's acceptance. I contend in my alternative reading of Hayek is the start state is the acceptance of Mises' calculation argument. Socialism cannot achieve the ends that it seeks because the means chosen are ineffective with regard to those ends. The recognition that despite the truth of Mises' argument, it was not going to deter attempts is what drives Hayek in the 1930s and into the 40s. Okay? I'll come back to this in a very short bit with regard to Hayek's essay on the trend of economic thinking. But, so if it's the case that Mises has this position, which is true, if you put it this way, this will be more colorful and maybe cause you to walk out of the room. But, it's similar like as if a physicist had demonstrated that if you can't flap your arms and fly to the moon, but yet a whole group of people believe that you could flap your arms and fly to the moon. What would the physicist then try to do? That's Hayek. Okay? Because at the time, no one believed that Mises was right except for, Hayek and Mises, of course. Everyone else was, content to argue that these guys were bonkers. And one of the things that's interesting in reading this and in this debate in this period of time is actually how Hayek and Mises continually declare victory when everyone else is saying that they're crazy. I mean, if you read their writings, you would think that everyone in the world believed exactly what they believed. Because they say, no one would ever believe other than this, but that actually wasn't the case. Everyone held this sort of other position. And what Hayek is trying to do is, in the wake of that sort of reality, so you have a truth statement that you believe, and then a reality of people trying to pursue it, both on a theoretical level and on a ideological level, trying to implement these policies, Hayek then takes on a a forked path here. He's going to focus on theory to try to show that his colleagues' attempts to beat Mises in theory are going to be misplaced. They're going to miss out. And in practice, you're going to generate unintended, undesirable consequences from your own point of view. So he's engaged in a two-pronged attack on socialism. The theory essays are the essays on knowledge and competition as a discovery procedure that are given here as the 35 is his volume that came out in 1935 that collects the essays, Mises and whatnot. It's called Collectivist Economic Planning. And then in 37 we have Economics and Knowledge. 40 is his review of Lange's work. And 45 is his classic paper, The Use of Knowledge in Society. In this regard, this is where he's trying to demonstrate that all the different efforts in the English language debate don't respond effectively to Mises's charge. Then, in practice, what he does in 1944 is he picks up and challenges the ideas that socialism could achieve its ends in a liberal manner, actually. So let me just walk you through this real quick. It's easy to understand the evolution of this debate in the way that that Hayek, as an economist, thought about it, which is that the very first criticism that any economist has against schemes of socialism is a private property rights argument. It's a property rights argument. And it's about incentives. That's almost what defines being an economist. Incentives matter. It's very hard for an economist to run around and argue that incentives don't matter or that scarcity doesn't exist. Frank Knight, the great Chicago School economist, used to offer an automatic A to any student who could write an economics on heaven. In all of his years, no student wrote a satisfactory essay on the economics of heaven. All right, I was a student of Kenneth Boulding and of Jim Buchanan, and Kenneth Boulding was a wonderful man. And during the semester that I was a student of both of those guys, we spent the entire semester doing nothing but reading Adam Smith's Deer and Beaver Model and putting all kinds of alternative assumptions on it or whatever. And I went and asked Kenneth Boulding, you know, why this was the case. And he said, oh, he says, that's just, you know, the great tradition of Frank Knight. And that's all he told me. I have no idea what it means. But I went through, I know everything about the Deer and Beaver Model. The other thing that Boulding said that was great is he described Knight as an engine of creativity without a clutch. And I always thought that was kind of an interesting description of him. But the basic idea that in the face of scarce resources, property rights evolve in order to minimize conflict and give individuals incentives to husband resources effectively is the basic argument against schemes for the collectivization of property. The second point, which is once I get this point across, what if I assume, as many socialists did in the early part of the 20th century, that we're going to have a change in the human spirit? So you won't need this kind of, to minimize the conflict. Under socialism, you'll have a transformation of the human spirit. So we will not have homo economicus, where we need to allocate scarce resources among competing ends, but instead a much more sort of, you know, free, socially spirited individual. Well, then Hayek argues, well, look, if you're going to do that, what you need to do is you still need to allocate those resources effectively. Mother Teresa might be altruistic, but she still wants to do her altruistic activity as efficiently as she possibly can. She wants to take care of the poor in the most efficient way that she's capable of taking care of the poor. Mother Teresa wouldn't want to take care of the poor inefficiently. That would, you know, defeat her purposes. And in order to do that, you're going to need some guide, some information in order to tell you how to allocate these resources effectively. If you want to do the right thing, you don't need to just be motivated to do the right thing. You need to know what the right thing to do is in any given situation. And what Hayek pointed out was that the relative monetary prices, provide this information to guide the production plans of some to mesh with the consumption demands of others, even if it's trying to do, you know, the best. All right, so now let's assume that the actors are, that they have this sort of information, or we have a supercomputer or something like that where we can, you know, get this information quickly and delivered to us, the givenness of the data. Well, then Hayek comes back and he has a third level of an argument, which is goes on in the 1930s and 40s, which is, if I assume away the property rights problems, and I assume, in fact, Hayek, by the way, I should point out, Hayek, unlike public choice theorists, went as far as to actually embrace the assumption here of benevolence. Because, and this is a trick pulled by Oscar Lange in the debate, it's very interesting. If you read it, it's an interesting thing. Lange argues in the debate, to talk about incentives is to become a sociologist. Now, for an economist,
this is one of the worst things you could be accused of, right? And so no one's going to talk about sociology issues here. So Hayek was forced by the assumptions of Lange. Seriously, go and read Lange's original piece. He says that you cannot talk about managerial incentives, because to talk about managerial incentives is to be a sociologist, not a technical economist. And so in the context of this debate, it's actually sort of a gauntlet being thrown down. And so Hayek is forced to sort of emphasize issues that are not related to this issue of benevolence or deviations from benevolence. So agents are assumed to be benevolent. And so then what happens is Hayek is going to focus on this issue of the innovation aspect of markets. Marginal costs need to be discovered afresh every day. They're not something that you need, that you have going into the market. They're actually the byproduct of a market process. And in fact, they're a byproduct of a particular context within a market in which you're engaged in trying to buy and sell resources on the market. The very nature of innovation is a function of the lure of pure profit. If you think about it, go back to his argument in the Copenhagen lecture. And what he's arguing there is that prices give us ex ante information. They give us the information that exists correctly right now. And then I engage in action based on that array of ex ante information. On the basis of my action, I receive profit and loss accounting statements. That's my ex post information. The very discrepancy between my ex post information and my ex ante information is what generates the lure of innovation, better ways to learn. You guys don't take tests regularly over here. You take them at the end of the year or whatever. But in the United States, we give the students lots and lots of tests because we're not allowed to fail anyone. So they, have to take tests, and then we throw out their bad grades and whatnot. And when you do that, what happens is you tell the students, usually you have to give them a review before they take an exam, and you say the test is going to be on chapters 1 through 10. And then what happens is the students, Homo Studenomicus allocates a scarce study time to study the information that I told them ex ante. And then I give them the test, and then we give them a grade back. You scored a 70, you scored an 80, or whatever. And on the basis of that, presumably, what the student does is then take the ex post information, the discrepancy between the ex ante and the ex post, and re-examines the way that they studied for the next test so that they learn. Learning is in fact a consequence of our errors. If we don't have errors, we're not going to learn. And what Hayek's argument here to Lange and whatnot is that the trial and process error, trial and error process that Lange sort of talks about, is going to be adjusted through the kind of administrative system, which is more cumbersome and whatnot, whereas in a market economy, we need to adjust freely and quickly and whatnot. And so this is where he's going to do this. So what we basically have here is three P's that generate three I's that are necessary for a social system. We have incentive, we have property, prices, and profit, and we have the three I's of incentives, information, and innovation. And the point that Hayek was trying to say is that if you don't have the three P's, you're not going to get the three I's. If you're not going to get the three I's, you're not going to have a very successful society. Okay? Then what he does is he comes and he recognizes in order to get property, prices, and profits, I need to have politics. We can't have political economy without politics. You need to put political back into political economy. And if we're going to do that, we need to have an infrastructure. And that infrastructure is going to deal with the questions of power and predation. And what Hayek's argument is, deviations from liberal politics, from a limited government, are going to in fact end up by unleashing the forces of power and predation rather than constraining. And that's what the road to serfdom is all about. All right. I'll pick this up a little bit. All right. So the LSE contribution. I'll come back. Okay. This is, beyond Lange to Lerner and Durbin and Robbins. And the question is, this is from Lionel Robbins' essay. Lionel Robbins was pretty much an ally of Hayek for most of their career. Personal reasons led to their fallout, not intellectual ones. Hayek went through a divorce, and Robbins didn't like that. Hayek had to escape to Arkansas, which allows you to get quickie divorces. And so that's how Hayek ended his career. Otherwise, he would have stayed at the LSE his entire career. And, you know, maybe you'd have a building named after him, the F.A. Hayek Library or something, but rather than Lionel Robbins' building. This is Robbins says, an individualist who recognizes the importance of public goods and a collectivist who recognizes the desirability of the maximum of individual freedom in consumption will find many points of agreement in common. The biggest dividing line of our day is not between those who differ about the organization as such, but between those who differ about the ends which organization has to serve. So what Robbins is trying to argue in this essay is that the socialists, the democratic socialists of the LSE, and the classical liberal economists, Hayek and Robbins, can agree that they should work together against those who want to challenge the ends of a liberal society. Okay? So what ends up by happening with this is that people like Durbin and Lerner try to argue that there's a possibility rather than what Hayek says, which is that if I engage in socialism, I will be led by the nose, as it were, to engage in behavior which no liberal would ever want to engage in. Robbins is sort of saying, well, if a socialist believes in individual freedom, collectivist who recognizes the desirability of individual freedom in consumption, that's the consumer sovereignty proposition, and are individuals who recognize the importance of public goods, they're like two halves of a coin. They're not really that far apart. Consumer sovereignty in the market socialist model then becomes a major part that Hayek is going to have to try to address in the 1930s. Now, when Lange first puts forth this model, Maurice Dobb, a Marxist at Cambridge, actually rejects the Dickinson-Lange model of market socialism because he says the pricing system is inconsistent with the socialist aspiration to abolish commodity production and transcend alienation. One of the ironies in all of this is that Hayek and Mises had to agree with Dobb that, you know, market socialism is precisely not socialism. It's basically market interventionism. It's not socialism anymore. We've changed the meaning of what we mean by socialism. Socialism here in the original meaning of the term is one in which you collectivize the means of production to achieve advanced material welfare such that you will have a burst of productivity and move into a post-scarcity world. This is how you have to understand the context of Mises' claims about impossibility. Mises was not saying that it's impossible to say you're a socialist while having a market economy. That's fine. And he certainly didn't say it's impossible to have to have full-blown socialism and lead to poverty. Right? Socialism is impossible only with regard to strict means-ends analysis. The means of collective ownership and the means of production are not consistent with advanced material production, which is a requirement for moving to a post-scarcity world. You can't have a post-scarcity world without advanced material production, right? That's how you get to post-scarcity. So Mises' argument has to be understood in that light. It's not the case that he was running around saying, calling yourself a socialist is impossible. Of course, that's not true, right? Everyone calls yourself a socialist. You call yourself a socialist if you live in Sweden, right? I'm a socialist, but you have a market economy. So there was a focus on the clarification of the term. And Dobb was very consistent in this. And he said, no, that model can't be accepted as socialist because it's not about the abolition of commodity production and the transcendence of alienation. But that didn't, no one really picked up on Dobb's thing. So instead what you had was Lerner. By the way, Ronald Coase tells a wonderful story of when he was at the LSE about Abba Lerner. I highly recommend that you look up Coase's discussions of the LSE because what Lerner did was he tried to get in touch with Trotsky down in Mexico to convince him that he had come up with the solution of the problem that, you know, they were facing in the Soviet Union with bureaucratization. And he tracked them down and he would talk about it in class all the time and all these things like that. And Coase tells a sort of wonderful story about all this stuff. Coase's whole thing on the theory of the firm is also a byproduct of this debate because he was in Arnold Plant's class and Arnold Plant was teaching the Hayek position. And Coase thought to himself, well, if markets are so efficient, how come we have firms who are islands of planning? And so what Coase did was he went out to try to come up with an answer of why it is that firms exist. Then, but the other side is the flip side, Coase also knew that you couldn't have one giant firm, and that's what leads to the whole literature on principal agency. What I'm trying to suggest is that this debate has tremendous legs to it in terms of things that went on, from not only the transaction cost theory of the firm, but also the examination of the principal agency problem and monitoring costs and all those kind of things that we associate with the work of Armin Alchin and Harold Demsetz. Again, originating here at the London School of Economics. So the idea is that if I have consumer goods, they will maximize individual freedom, and I can have a socialist economy. And what Durbin argues is that we are socialists in our economics because precisely we are liberals in our philosophy. And this is what Hayek is now going to have to try to contend with. And the reason why I think Durbin and Lerner and these guys got it wrong, and I have to, you know, confess a shameless self-promotion now, I have an essay coming out in the European Journal of Political Economy on this. It's called On Reading Hayek, Choice, Consequence, and the Road to Serfdom. And I think that a lot of people miss the point about what the road to serfdom is, which is that it's a tragic tale. And when Lerner and these guys talk, they assume that what I want to do is what I achieve. So if a socialist says, I will allow freedom in consumer good prices, and ipso facto derive the producer good prices from that, because that's an equilibrium proposition that I can do that, that therefore I can collectivize the means of production without sacrificing consumer sovereignty. And what Hayek is arguing is, no, that's not right. The reason being is that you cannot assume this ipso facto because we're not in equilibrium. So the consumer good prices don't automatically, so the price of a ham sandwich doesn't automatically determine the price of a pig, okay? Instead, the supply and demand conditions for the pig, which are particular to that point in time, all right, are going to, in fact, have to be going on, and we need to know what the demand and supply of pigs are, and it's constantly changing, preferences are changing. This is his point of his tin example, okay, how it is that the constantly changing conditions have to be accommodated for through the price system, all right, and what you're going to get then is when the plan is frustrated because you can't agree on the ultimate ends, there's going to be a limit on agreement, you're going to progressively move towards less and less democratic means of attaining these things. And so the road to serfdom is a tragedy. It's a tragic tale about unintended consequences. It's not the bastards getting control and the bastards do the wrong thing. That's what people thought, and that's what, like, for example, Durbin, in his review of the road to serfdom, he says, we're not fascists. We're Brits. And if you're a Brit, you're civilized. So how can Hayek say that you would come under the influence of fascist ideas? Because we're British. And good British people are not fascists. And what Hayek's argument is, it's a warning. It's not a deterministic thing either. It's a warning. And what it says is that if you go down this path and you pursue it further and further down the road, you will be led to adopt more and more dictatorial mandates in order to make the plan work. You can't do it. In this regard, again, it's not exactly the same thing, but again, to show you the legs of this research program, very shortly after this, Kenneth Arrow wrote a seminal piece on the limits of democratic agreement and showing that you cannot achieve those kind of efficiency results that you would expect through the democratic amalgamation process. This is, this is a very key point. Hayek's point about the agreement and the limits of agreement anticipate the arguments that Arrow has in his impossibility theorem, because it's all about the inability to amalgamate through democratic process those kind of preferences up so that we can achieve efficient allocation of the public goods provision through democratic means. It's a very, all right. So, I have 5 minutes, okay, 5 minutes? All right. Bear with me here. So, Hayek's, point here, and what I want to suggest is that Hayek's history is one of challenges by his colleagues and his own intellectual frustration. This is how you have to understand how he went off. And all of us who do intellectual life can understand this. If I'm having a debate with Jan over the nature of a free society and I don't understand where he's coming from, I go back home and I stay up at night and I think about it, right? And then that makes me think of other things. Hayek felt that about his colleagues. Here's the basic idea. He wants to put forth this unintended consequence problem. He wants to suggest that it's not a preoccupation with equilibrium. We shouldn't have that. We should have a reconciliation process. And this leads him out of economics and into what Bruce Caldwell calls his abuse of reason project. This is where Hayek starts to use the methods of reason to whittle down the claims of reason, following Hume in that regard. And this abuse of reason project takes on two different forms, methodological and ideological. And here, let me just go through this real quick. The abuse of reason, remember Hayek's own words about economics and knowledge that I put up. They set him off on this philosophical path. What I want to suggest is a slightly different take, one that is not inconsistent with Hayek, but stresses more his frustration with his colleagues and students at the LSE. For anyone who's read this Hayek story, it's a phenomenal story of success and failure. In fact, Sylvia Nassar, who's famous for the Beautiful Mind story, I knew her when I was teaching at NYU. And in fact, I was having breakfast with her the week after John Nash won the Nobel Prize. And we were talking about Gregory Menkew's textbook, which he had sold a thing for $1 million on. And then she told me that she was going to have an article coming out in the Sunday Times on John Nash's story. And she was thinking about writing a book. And I said, oh, no one's ever going to want to hear a story about John Nash. So she doesn't, I'm not a very good predictor. She argues that scientists, all great stories are people who rise to great fame, crashing defeats, and then rise up again. And Nash, of course, fits that. But so does Hayek. Tremendous fame, all right, at the age of, 31 or something like that, he's a famous economist. And everyone, when he came here, I'm waiting for this to happen to me, but it won't. But, when he came here, everyone became a Hayekian. He gave these series of lectures, and everyone became a Hayekian. Within a decade, no one was a Hayekian. And all of his students that were, in fact, close to him had moved away from him. So imagine the frustration with this. And by the way, to put up the point about Hayek and being wide open, you have to realize that he was a supervisor of Abel Lerner, all right? He's a supervisor of G.L.S. Shackle, all right? It's not just the people that believed with him that he actually supervised their thesis on. So I have a slight idea. So the frustration with his colleagues and his students and how this frustration set him in a quest for answers. I'm a smart guy. How the hell are these guys not listening to me anymore? That's the kind of quest that he's after. The intellectual exercise here is to compare Hayek's inaugural lecture at the LSE with Oscar Lange's on the economic theory of socialism. In 1933, what Hayek argued right here, not in this building, but somewhere around here, was the following. Economics was born as a discipline out of the successive examination and refutations of utopian schemes. That liberal economists are as concerned with the welfare of the poor as the socialists are. But they recognize the problems of interventionism and planning and the power of the market to ameliorate those problems. In fact, in 1933, Hayek wrote that recent additions to the knowledge about socialism have made the probability of a solution of our difficulties through planning appear less rather than more likely. This is the sort of arguments that we were just going through. That only by denying, this is the important point, only by denying economic laws, as the historical school had done, can you adapt the policies of interventionism and socialism. A properly trained economist would be more skeptical about the workability of such schemes. The irony of the age, Hayek warns, is that our economic understanding has improved with advances in economic thought, but the public acceptance of the historicists. Refusing to believe in the general laws, the historical school had the special attraction to intellectuals and the public that its method was constitutionally unable to refute even the wildest of utopias.
and was therefore not likely to bring the disappointment associated with theoretical analysis. To someone who held this position, imagine the sheer bewilderment that he must have experienced when within a few short years he was confronted with the arguments of Keynes, Lange, and his students, such as Lerner. Especially Lange and Lerner, because they used marginal analysis and neoclassical market theory to forge an argument for socialism. It is my contention that this experience in the 1930s set Hayek off on his quest for understanding that led him to abandoning technical economics and branching into social philosophy and political economy. All right, so this is my last slide, but I've probably run out of time, but it's basically about how all the cool things that Hayek did are now like really cool in economics. And so you can find out all these different things in Timur Kuran, you know, Vernon Smith, Andre Schleifer, in this sort of institutional cognitive sort of direction. The emphasis here on, this is Vernon Smith's Nobel Prize address, which I highly recommend, the difference between constructivist versus ecological rationality. And the need for simple rules for a complex world. So that my basic point here is that Hayek, which I've run out of time to convey, but Hayek's contribution to science, public policy, and also in generating an ideological vision is still very much alive, and it's not a dead issue. Hayek still is part of our evolutionary present, and there's a lot of potential in his ideas. So, on that, I want to thank you for this opportunity to give this address here today, and also thank you for your attention, and gladly open it up for any questions. Thank you.
We have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions, but I'm going to, if it's all right with you, Pete, why don't you sort of regulate your own questions, unless it gets out of order, in which case I'll give it a central planning.
You have to have some questions. Otherwise, I'll... Yes, go ahead.
Can I ask you just to wait for the mic?
Yeah, you're talking about liberal, and the word liberal in the U.S. today is not very popular word, to put it politely. And doesn't it concern you that... that in itself, and that, as far as I can see it, it's not much of a capitalist or a free market system that is in existence in the U.S., and also the militarization of the U.S. The development is deeply concerning, as far as I see it.
On this issue about the word liberal in the United States, it's completely backwards. I mean, I think that the best way to look at this is in the early 1990s, and to look at where in Eastern Central Europe and where the word liberal was used. And in that sense, it was used in the correct sense. Whereas the conservatives were the people who wanted to preserve the old order of the communist state, and the liberals were the ones who were challenging and wanting to open up the economy to liberalization and whatnot. Liberal is also conveyed correctly when you talk about issues like trade liberalization, deregulation. You want to liberalize the phone industry or something like that. That's sort of the meaning of the term. On the United States, this is not the time for me to comment on that. I did have a paper that I gave at Cambridge on liberalism in a post 9/11 world. And I'll be talking about that at the Institute for Economic Affairs next week. And, maybe you want to go to that and hear me discuss American foreign policy and what I think a liberal should do to defend a liberal society. The United States is not a free market economy. Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I don't... Yeah, but I don't think Britain's a free market economy either. It depends on what you mean by a free market economy and how relative it is. I mean, I think one of the big pressing problems, again, it's not my area of expertise tonight, but the big pressing problem in the United States, which I understand you guys are having right now, is that there's certain bubbles which are now seem to be ready to bust.
I was reading the thing about the housing bubble here and the decline in housing prices, and the decline in housing prices that's taking place in the United States as well after a buildup. And, you know, I mean, but if I could predict that, I wouldn't be here, right? I'd be in Barbados. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is it right that Hayek conceded the public good argument for state intervention? And if he did make that concession, do you think that that was a mistake on his part?
Hayek's position on public goods is ingenious, actually. It's in the Law, Legislation, and Liberty. And what he argues is for not that public goods are... he doesn't take the sort of other Austrian tact, which is to claim that public goods don't exist. What he does is he says, okay, there might be public goods, but there's no reason to have a monopoly provider in it. And so if it's a natural monopoly provider, it would emerge in the market. And instead, what we should always have is new forms of competition. So what he did was he freed it up for these things that when changes in technology can happen, what used to be a public good could now maybe be privately provided, and therefore eliminate the idea that it's a public good. And to give you an example of this, there's a really neat book that's being coming out by a friend of mine named Dan Klein, which is on the half-life of public goods, which is an example of all the cases in which goods that were at one time had to be public goods, like roads or whatever, who now with modern technology, we can now fence in and police and we could privately provide them. And so this is Hayek anticipated the kind of argument that Dan Klein is running, or for that matter, you know, kind of argument that Milton Friedman had in Capitalism and Freedom, which is, if you remember, Friedman's argument at that point is that, you know, you have monopolies maybe, right? Let's assume we have monopolies. The question is, for the performance in the economy, is it better to have a regulated monopoly or an unregulated monopoly? And Friedman actually made an argument for unregulated monopolies despite whatever problems they have, because of the difficulties in the regulation or nationalization of monopolies. And so I think that you know, Hayek's position on this is somewhat unique. It's certainly not the same position that, say, someone like Murray Rothbard held. So it's a slightly different position. Yeah.
Hi, what do you think Hayek's view would have been on further economic EU integration for Britain at the moment? Oh.
I got done telling Tim before I came up here, I don't give many of these public talks, but unfortunately, recently I'm not very good at it, I don't think, but people don't know that till I'm an experienced good. Like, you have to purchase it before you know, so. The University of Carleton in Canada has an EU center there, European center, and they had me come up to give the inaugural address on the EU. Now, the problem with any kind of situations like the European Union or contemporary policies in Russia or anything like that is that it's happening day to day, and for the economists, what you want to do is you want to do analysis, not necessarily journalism, and it's very easy to fall into that. So the easiest way to avoid that is to give scenarios rather than point predictions, because you just don't know what all the things are. So what I did at this talk up there, which is on the EU and the accession countries, Czech Republic, Poland, whatnot, was to give various different possibilities about what might occur to those countries and to the economic environment there. And in the best case scenario, of course, Europe becomes like the Treaty of Rome tried to make it be, this sort of free, you know, flow of goods and services and all these things like that. And at worst, what you end up by having is being run by an overzealous bureaucracy and whatnot. And the question is, what is your probability of one or the other? And for public choice reasons, it's my own opinion that, you know, France and Germany are going to sort of try to make sure that they rule the EU. And if you look at the discussions on the EU Constitution, you can sort of see this sort of scenario to make sure that they protect themselves against competition from, lower wage competitors and other products. And so what I actually see is that rather than a united Europe, that it would have been much better to have a more decentralized Europe, federalism, interstate federalism and competition among the different states, including the Euro. Though I have to say that the new symbol on the LSE is kind of neat. That has, you know, if we followed my advice, it wouldn't exist because you wouldn't have the Euro at the end. So I'm buying it for all my students. That's a shirt I'm bringing back home to give them. But I think Thatcher was right. You know, I can say that without getting killed. I think Thatcher was right. You know, her argument is that, you didn't want to roll back the bureaucracy on Downing Street in order to suffer from Eurocrats in Brussels. And I think that that warning is a very good warning. And there's no reason to believe that her warning, you know, so many years ago isn't one that we should also be heeding today. That much said, scientifically, what I did do in this presentation, which surprised me, was I looked at the tax rates of the accession countries, and I thought Estonia would have a higher, you know, a better economic freedom score before it joined the EU than what it did after joining, but that's not right. Estonia actually has become more free by trying to, and I was wrong about that. That was my prior going in. So if it's the case that the EU represents more liberal policies for countries joining it, then we will actually have more liberalism, more freedom, more, you know, economic prosperity through joining it. But a lot of the policy harmonization things is what I'm afraid of, because I think in order to have vibrant political and policy life, what you need to do is decentralize government authority and decentralize regulation to the localist level. This is an argument that's put forth by someone who I think very highly of, Barry Weingast, in a series of essays written in the mid-90s on what he calls market preserving federalism. What are the specific institutions framework within which we can expect policy competition to generate economically efficient policies? I think that Weingast is very useful in that regard, and that would lead me to believe in more decentralized rather than centralized and harmony. Sorry. Yeah.
Is there a Hayekian position on pseudo-markets, say carbon trading, carbon credits?
Yeah, there is. It's a contentious one. There's a debate among the sort of free market environmentalists, like the people at the Political Economy Research Center in Bozeman, Montana, who actually defend these kind of, you know, markets. And then there's other people who argue that these markets are basically a form of market socialism with shadow prices, and therefore would run into the same problems that a Longa model would run into. So it's a contentious issue of debate, both sides claiming Hayek as a justification for their position. By the way, it's a very interesting position, actually, on this regard. You can think about markets as being, you know, is it better that prices are decentralized and administratively set decentralized, or is it better that they're administratively set centralized? So, for example, in Poland in the 1980s, you know, it's not like reforms just began in 1989. The Poles were trying to engage in a series of reforms throughout the 1980s, and one of the things that they did under the name of calling on Hayek was they decentralized their pricing administration. So now local levels set the prices rather than the market, but local governments would set them. Now, is that better than, you know, centralized pricing? In some sense, yes, but it's still not the right way. I might look at this whole thing on carbon, you know, markets and things like that as doing that. And I think one of the more interesting work along the creation of markets nowadays is these betting markets, the development of betting markets, and the claim that they are better aggregators of information than, say, scientific expertise and things like that. So if you want to know who's going to win the election, don't listen to the pundits. Go and look at the Iowa stock market, you know, and that will tell you what the real spread is, that kind of stuff.
Okay, we're going to talk for one more question.
Sorry, on a more historical note, what was Hayek's position on the development of monetarism and then new classical macroeconomics?
This is a very interesting question. It's an important technical question. Hayek and Friedman were the intellectual leaders of the classical liberal movement, all right? So in their lifetimes, we do not know what their comments really are on one another, except for little tidbits now, because they sealed their documents with one another as long as they both were alive, because they didn't want to have the world be caught up in the controversy between Friedman and Hayek on issues like monetarism and other kinds of things. So we'll know about that unfortunately, within a few years, probably. And Bruce Caldwell will be, you know, obviously the person that has all that kind of stuff come out. We do know that Hayek believes is a very strong critic of macroeconomics. And to the extent that Milton Friedman adopted a macroeconomic framework, he was adopting the very Keynesian framework which Hayek objected to. So in that sense, Milton Friedman was a Keynesian. And all he did was show the empirical assumptions lead to different results of the model. Robert Lucas is not a Keynesian. And what he did is, he's in this regard, he's much more influenced by Hayek. And in fact, if you go back and you look at his early writings, Hayek is a major influence on those early writings under two fronts. One of them is a methodological front about the issue of equilibrium in business cycles. That what Hayek argued against Keynes was that if you begin in a world with unemployment, you can't explain unemployment. It's a simple methodological point, and it's correct. If I begin in a world where there's idle resources, how can I then ever give rise to the explanation of how we get idle resources? I just assume it. And what Hayek said is you have to begin in a world of full employment, introduce a shock, get the unemployment, and then you've now explained why it is unemployment arises. And Lucas takes off from this in his original understanding of the notion of equilibrium theory of the business cycle. The second influence was that Lucas actually tried to model in one of his more, in the beginning, one of his more influential papers was this island paper and the difference between the noise and the signal between relative prices and general price level. And it was an extremely powerful, you know, paper in that regard. Unfortunately, two things happened. One of them was, as the Austrian community existed in the United States, scream foul. It's a huge mistake. You get a guy like Lucas, who's one of the brightest bulbs on the planet, and he says he likes what you're doing. You don't sort of say, don't say you like it, you know, because I like being no one listening to me, and now someone's listening. And so that was a huge mistake, all right? And so that was the first one. The second one is a more correct one, which is Kevin Hoover wrote this wonderful book on the two monetarisms and pointed out that Hayek was actually saying things different from Lucas. And that book had a huge influence on Lucas, and he said, I refuse to then call myself a neo-Austrian. He used to call himself a neo-Austrian model of the thing, because he was harking back to what he called pre-Keynesian business cycle theory, and he couldn't rely on Friedman. He had to go back to pre-Friedman. And that was Hayek at first, and Lucas changed from that. My own view on Bob Lucas is, I mean, he's another person who just had a tremendous amount of vibrancy in his research program, and you see it in the most recent Nobel Prize. I mean, with the whole Kinlan and Prescott sort of brilliant sort of work on rules versus discretion, which I want to suggest, by the way, comes back to Hayek's emphasis on the nature of the rule of law and predictability, and you could add in there credibility. And so in some sense, Hayek, you know, provides that infrastructure that, that then becomes that argument. But it's also the case that Lucas and the whole work that we're doing in development economics is driven by Lucas's mechanics of economic development. So if we actually gave Nobel Prizes multiple times, Lucas is probably the candidate, along with maybe Gary Becker, that probably deserves it, you know, multiple times for his innovations. And so I think it was a, you know, sort of a big sad mistake that the Austrians didn't jump on to that bandwagon. And but anyway, that's it's a good question.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it just remains for me to thank Pete for a really entertaining and informative lecture, and I think above all to remind us, those of us who have the privilege of being at the LSE, that we really are standing on shoulders of giants, and we should remember that every day that we're here. Thank you very much, Pete.